Hi, I'm Tom Power. Welcome to season two of Toy Heart, a podcast about bluegrass. I'm really looking forward to you hearing what we have in store for you for this season. You're going to hear from Allison Krauss and Larry Sparks and Mike Compton and Lori Lewis and Tim O'Brien and so much more. Listen, if you're not already subscribed to our podcast, do me a favor, please do so. If you have someone in your life who likes bluegrass, if you have someone in your life who got into the music through Billy Strings or Molly Tuttle and wants to know more about the music, please pass the podcast on to them. It is so good to be back for season two of Toy Heart. We'll see you soon. Later on.
Season two of Toy Heart with Tom Power is out now. Subscribe and listen where you get podcasts or thebluegrasssituation.com.
Welcome to You Wanted a Hit, a podcast in which we discuss unlikely, perplexing, and positively bizarre songs that swept the nation and often the world. Hit songs that, looking back, make us think, how did this get played on the radio? Do people actually like this? Do we like this? Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm your co-host, Michael Smith, and I'll be discussing one song per episode with my co-host and fellow music fanatic, pop culture enthusiast Theo Beidler. Each episode, we'll take turns exploring the song, while the other host has no idea what song will be the focus until we hit play. I want to welcome everybody to the 3-year anniversary episode.
Wow.
If you wanted a hit, which is also our 60th episode.
I didn't know either of these facts. I'm already learning.
It's great.
It's going to be a good episode.
Yeah. So this episode is just about our podcast. We're just going to give a history.
If we've done 59 episodes, that means that there's some history here. You know, we really could dig in.
Yeah, we really could.
I vaguely remember our first. I remember some of the first ones. What was the first song?
It was Right Said Fred, I'm Too Sexy.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
That's a good one, actually.
It is a good one. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I've been waiting for this moment so that I could crack a nice canned snack here.
I'm drinking the Sierra Nevada Celebration myself.
Ooh, well.
Fresh hop, IPA.
Does that mean tonight's song is cause for celebration?
It's a drinking song.
All right. Love that.
I'll tell you that much. In fact, I was kind of on the fence about having a beer, and I was like, I have to have a beer. But anyway, without further ado, here is our 60th song we've discussed on the show.
Oh, here we go. Yeah, you have to crack a beer for this one. I like this song. This is fun.
Who doesn't like this song?
It's so absurd. Yeah, it's just a fun jam. Like, even if it's definitely, from when I was growing up, was not a country fan growing up, as you know.
Neither was I.
I am now. But this is the kind of song that you look at, you point to, and you're like, country's so dumb. I mean, look what this shit is. But at the end of the day, deep down inside, you do kind of love it. And then you get into country and you're like, yeah, that song rocks. Fuck yeah.
You know, I didn't find a whole lot about the studio musicians in the song, but man, those guitar licks and that guitar tone, super sweet.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is Chattahoochee by Alan Jackson, released in 1993.
Damn, 93. Wow.
Yep. Alan Jackson was born and raised in Noonan, Georgia. On October 17th, 1958.
Georgia boy. All right.
You know anything about Noonan?
I don't. It sounds like a very small town.
It's fairly small. It's about 40 miles outside of Atlanta.
Okay.
And its population is around 40,000 in the most recent census. So it's a proper town.
Is Alan Jackson the biggest thing to come from Noonan, Georgia?
Maybe. There is a highway named after him, the Alan Jackson Highway.
Wow, that's an honor.
But it's also the hometown of multi-platinum R&B singer Monica.
Oh.
Yep.
Wow.
As well as a crazy list of NFL and MLB players.
Oh, interesting.
I kept scrolling. I was like, there's like 30 pro athletes from this town, and they're all MLB and NFL, and that's it.
Whoa.
It's interesting. Their high schools must be killing it.
Is there like an academy or something, or is it just random?
I don't know. A lot of ball going on. Noonan is noted for its abundance of antebellum architecture, as it was largely spared by the Union Army during the Civil War because it was a hospital town.
That's a fun fact.
Allen grew up with his four siblings in a small house that was built around his grandfather's tool shed. I'm not exactly sure what that means for the layout of the house.
Yeah.
I'm guessing it started as a tool shed and they just kept building on it as they had more people.
Sounds very redneck.
So,
okay.
So a modest upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
His mom lived in the house until she passed in 2017.
Wow.
For a while, Allen slept in the hallway until one of his older siblings moved out.
Wow.
Allen started singing at an early age, both at church and at home with his family, but mostly in groups, not like singing lead and stuff. Obviously, this was mostly gospel music, but in high school, a friend introduced him to country singers such as Hank Williams Jr. and John Anderson. Allen followed that path and started a country duo as a teenager. I could not find their name or their music, unfortunately. But in 1976, at age 18, Allen joined the band Dixie Steel.
Dixie Steel.
Named after a brand of nails.
And that's country right there.
Yep. I couldn't find any of their music, but I did find a photo of the band.
Wow. Wait, which one is he?
He's in the middle at the top.
Oh, yeah. All right. I can see it.
Looks like he's been wearing a hat for like 2 weeks.
Yeah. Man, they all look like a bunch of goobers.
Yeah,
like
it's great. Around this time, Allen married his high school sweetheart, Denise, who was a flight attendant.
Wow.
While she was working in the air, Allen was at home working all kinds of jobs, including Kmart forklift operator, construction, and also car sales. And I found this photo of him from when he was selling cars.
Damn, look at him. I'd buy a car from him.
Allen Jackson, sales representative.
He looks like he knows what he's talking about. What kind of car is this? What do we got here? It's
like, looks like a Datsun or something.
Oh, you think so? He seems like an American guy, though. He'd be rocking like a Chevy or something. Plymouth.
But he was still playing in Dixie Steel and playing local bars. And he did make a demo of his own song called New Traditional. Here's a taste of what was on New Traditional.
Merle and George. Like that.
Yep. You could tell what he was into. It's called Merle and George. He sounds like Merle in this recording.
He does, yeah. You can also tell Allen Jackson is like pretty...
Yeah.
A lot of these songs we cover, the early music, I'm always kind of like, okay, I can see it. It's very different. This feels very like Allen Jackson. I like it.
He's got that, like, he kind of has a throaty quality that I can't quite describe, where he's like pushing with his throat.
Yeah. It's a unique voice.
Yeah, it definitely is. But you can tell he's listening to a shit ton of Merle Haggard.
Wait, what year is this?
Early 80s. Wow.
Sounds good.
So his wife, Denise, carried some of these New Traditional tapes with her when she was out working on the airlines.
Mm.
One day, she saw country superstar Glenn Campbell at the airport.
All right.
The Rhinestone Cowboy himself. Also a jam. She chased him down and gave him a copy of the demo. And Glenn, I mean, this is just like all-timer status here. He listened and then connected Denise and Allen with his publisher in Nashville.
That would never happen nowadays. Like, that is such an awesome Americana 1980s yeah. country story.
I had to verify it a couple times.
That's
and there are some awesome. Stories that are like, oh, she gave him like a, she wrote down her name. And it's like,
yeah,
he wouldn't have just hit her.
Right,
up.
Yeah,
he got the,
didn't happen.
He got the
but
demo.
This could happen.
Yeah. And she said she carried around his tapes.
So. Wow. I love this.
So that was enough to get Denise and Allen to pick up and move to Nashville.
I mean, they got car dealerships in Nashville. It's always a fallback. They got a big airport there for Denise, yeah. You know?
Although she's probably flying out of Atlanta at the time, much bigger airport than Nashville.
At the time, for sure. This is probably just after the movie Nashville, but which is a fantastic film that everyone should watch.
I don't know if I've seen that movie.
It's like a classic, but I think it was late 70s.
Mm.
And the airport featured prominently in that movie. So.
Oh, okay.
You should watch it.
All right. So upon their arrival in Nashville, Allen spent time honing his songwriting and singing backing vocals in recording sessions. But his main day job was working in the mailroom at TNN, the Nashville Network.
Yeah. Wow.
You remember TNN?
I mean, I know, but I know of it.
Hmm.
Way before my time.
I used to see it channel surfing when I was a kid.
Yeah?
Yeah, definitely.
See, that's how uncountry I was back in the day. I probably need to pick up on it.
Oh, I would just be, you know,
I remember it was like channel and be like, they spelled TNT wrong.
It was like channel 30 something. It was a little after ESPN, but before Nickelodeon. So,
you know. I don't know. Yeah, honestly, I don't know that we had it in Philly. You might have had it in bumfuck Pennsylvania.
Well, I was in Central PA.
Yeah,
I was
Central PA.
I grew up in Appalachia.
We didn't have it over there by the water.
Well, for those who don't recall, TNN was the precursor to Spike TV, which is now Paramount Network. And TNN was based at Opryland in Nashville and played country music videos like CMT, but also showed adjacent Southern programming, such as live country music concerts, bull riding, fishing, auto racing. And then in the 90s, a lot of pro wrestling and reruns of Dukes of Hazzard in Dallas.
Honestly, it sounds like an awesome channel that I would watch more now than I would have in my younger years. It sounds great. Fishing, NASCAR, wrestling, intermixed right? with country music. I'm here for it.
One show that was on this network on primetime was called You Can Be a Star, which was a country music singing contest similar to Star Search. It's like a low-budget American Idol for country music.
Yeah, but way before American Idol.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
She has a lot of charisma.
Did it take place at Opryland?
Yeah. Like your delivery. Yeah. I like the tune, right. too.
So Alan learned of this show while working in the mailroom, and he auditioned to be on it,
Great song.
And he got
Great
on the
job.
Show. Here's All right. Thank you Al very. Jackson
Diane, oh, wow.
on TNN's You Can Be a Star.
We'll Who's that? Keith with Star
Wars. Stars. His name is Keith, and we'll learn about him in a second.
Thanks, Jim Ed. We're here with Al, who's going to do a little bit of singing. George, this is one of my favorite songs. He Stopped Loving Her Today.
He said, I'll love you till I die.
I mean,
she told him you
great. Again. Die. He just looks like a younger version of Alan Jackson, which I know is a thing, and obviously that is what this is.
He also picked one of the most famously She's difficult songs to sing, George Jones' He Stopped Loving Her Today. Like, one of the greatest, like, vocal performances in country music.
He's doing it.
He sounds good. As I said, dude loved George Jones and Merle Haggard.
He also looks like a guy who... Like, he's obviously singing really well, but he kind of has that attitude and the look that someone just was like, hey, you should go up there and sing. Like, all right.
Yeah.
You know, he's like a little bit like blasé about it.
Alan, you should sing karaoke. Yeah, I guess so. And then just kills it.
Yeah, exactly. 1962. All right. Do we get to see the scores here? Is that it?
No, it's the only clip I found. It sounded good, though.
Yeah, I like it.
So that was Al on TNN's You Can Be a Star.
Al Jackson.
Notably, the judge at the beginning, that you asked if that's Keith Whitley, was Keith Stiegel.
Oh, Keith Stiegel. I have no idea who that is. Keith Whitley was the only Keith that I knew in right. country music back in the day, so it was a shot in the dark. Right.
And Keith Whitley came up on our Achy Breaky Heart episode.
That was definitely one of the early episodes, though.
I think they're from the same town.
Yeah.
So that was Keith Stiegel. He was a singer and guitarist playing in Texas and Louisiana in the 70s until Kris Kristofferson heard him and encouraged him to move to Nashville.
Huh.
Keith himself had a few charting hits in the 80s, including this top 10 country single. This is called Pretty Lady.
Got that like 80s synth going on.
I know we've talked about this before, but 80s country production was so bad.
Oh, yeah.
Like, luckily, around the time that Chattahoochee came out, the production was getting better again. But God, like, the synthesized reverberated drums yeah. and the... like, I can't even listen to it sometimes.
This gives me... I mean, this is definitely, like, there was a time of certain Texas country artists, like Pat Green.
Mm.
And this definitely has that vibe to it. Oh, it's yeah. like a little... This is almost like Jimmy Buffett. Country-esque.
Yeah, I could see that. Or like, it's... Well, country is always a few years behind in the trends that are on pop and rock music.
True.
And I feel like they were still hung up on the 70s, like, schlock rock kind of kind of vibe.
Yeah, or even like the 70s.
Just like kind cheesy of like, pop rock.
Almost like the 70s R&B that became pop. Like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't hate it.
It's fine. Anyway, after this, he focused on production for the rest of his career. And probably because he heard the production, he's like, I can do better than this. And in this time, he worked with Mickey Gilley, Al Jarreau, Randy Travis, and some other notable names. And although Alan, or Al Jackson, didn't win on the show, Keith liked what he heard, and he took a meeting with Alan.
All right.
And Alan showed up to the meeting with a Kroger bag full of cassettes full of songs he'd written.
God damn, I love this man.
And many of these songs ended up on his first three albums.
I love that you knew the Kroger bag as well. whether it was documented or you just made that up.
Oh, it was documented. It was documented. Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah. I saw it more than once.
It's a tangent. One of my favorite memories, I've told you the story before, of working in music was when my first year working music, essentially I was like a glorified intern. I was sent on the road to essentially chaperone a contest winner. And the contest was you got to quote unquote, like be a roadie with Tim McGraw for a couple of days. And so you would have your own tour bus and you would travel with Tim's tour for three or four dates or whatever it was in Florida. And the guy who won lived in Florida. So we took the tour bus down to Florida to pick him up along the way. And I was essentially like the quote unquote tour manager. So I go to this guy's door. He lives in a
wait, you're the tour manager for the person who won the contest. Winner. You're tour managing just a civilian.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I've never heard you tell the story.
It's a glorified intern job. And I knock on the guy's door. He lives in a double wide trailer. Comes the door and he's like, yeah. I'm like, hey, like, you're the contest winner. I'm trying to be like bubbly, you know? I'm like, here's your tour bus. Let's go. And he's like, all right. I can bring like whatever I want. I was like, yeah. He's like, I can bring drinks. I was like, yeah, man. It's like, it's your tour bus. You can do whatever you want. He's like, all right, 1 second. So he goes back in and I expect him to come out with like a case of beer, you know? But he just comes out with a Kroger bag with a couple of loose beers in it. And he's like, all right, let's go. And we get in the bus, we start driving and we go for like an hour. And he's like, you like beer? I'm like, yeah. He's like, what do you drink? I was like, oh, I don't know. I mean, you know, Yingling, Bud Light, whatever. And he just like stared at me for like a couple seconds and goes, you like Natty Light? I was like, yes, of course. Who doesn't?
You're like, I just got out of college.
And he like opened his little Kroger bag and threw me a Natty Light. And I was like, all right, this is going to be a long weekend.
And you spent the whole weekend with this guy?
Uh-huh.
That's fantastic.
It was a trip.
There's got to be more stories.
Oh, there are.
We'll talk about it next time I see you. That's amazing. And hey, the East Nashville Kroger is a fixture of the music scene in Nashville. You go in there, you'll see someone whose music you listen to.
That's true.
There's songs about the East Nashville Kroger.
For better or worse, yeah.
Yeah. Kroger, just a keystone of country music.
Mm-hmm. Wow, honestly, yeah.
So Keith and Alan, they're getting along. They start recording a new demo to shop around to labels. And eventually, BMG bit and signed Alan as the first artist on their new Arista imprint, Arista Nashville.
Wow.
Which closed up shop a couple years ago.
Wasn't Alan's fault.
Remarkably, Alan Jackson was 32 years old.
Oh, all right.
Well, you know, late in the game for first record contract, but, you know,
yeah,
kids.
Yeah, good for him.
Never give up.
I mean, there's still hope for me in my music career.
Yeah, right? He doesn't have a music career, everybody. People are going to start Googling.
No, I do not.
Here in the Real World, Alan Jackson's debut album.
Wait, Here in the Real World was the name of the album?
Yeah.
I don't know. Okay.
Well, produced by Keith Stiegel, was released in 1990. It had 4 top 5 country hits.
Wow.
All written or co-written by Jackson.
Wow.
And went platinum.
Damn.
The most enduring song from the album was Chasing That Neon Rainbow.
Oh, I know that one.
Which recounted his journey from singing with his family at home, to playing in bars around Georgia, to cutting records in Nashville.
Yeah.
Here's that tune if you want to revisit it a little bit.
absolutely do. Mama used I definitely haven't seen the video, so.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it either. Like, I know this song, but not as familiar really as some of these other songs. It's a good song.
Yeah.
He's still very Merle Haggard at this point.
Definitely.
Sounds so much like it. So, big hit. Platinum album. Alan and Keith got to work quickly on the follow-up album, Don't Rock the Jukebox.
All right, that's a little better.
Which was released in 1991 and had a number one country hit with the title track, Don't Rock the Jukebox. You know this one, right?
I'm sure I do.
Probably next to Chattahoochee, this is the one I know the most.
He's rocking the same guitar in this video here as well. Love that guitar.
I mean, it's a classic, just honky-tonking song.
I do recognize it now.
And the song's essentially about he doesn't want to hear rock on the jukebox. He wants to hear country. And it references George Jones. It says, I want to hear some Jones.
Everyone references George Jones, man. Maybe Alan Jackson was the guy that started.
I know, but he did a lot. I also just wish country radio still played shit sound like that. But anyway.
You not a Luke Bryan fan?
Oh, God. It's like, I mean, the same genre. So if you're looking at Alan Jackson's career here, you'd imagine that this might be like one of his most enduring songs, part of his legend, the one people talk about, because it was inescapable in country music that year and beyond. It was everywhere. And he'd really placed himself as a forward-thinking singer-songwriter who had a knack for combining traditional country and Western with modern hooks and studio sounds for the early 90s. More dive bar than arena, because we all know who was coming up at that time playing arenas.
Little Garthy?
Headset.
The headset.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Has its place, but very different. A little more modest. But, you know, this kind of was the time where country's starting to enter its arena rock moment, and he's kind of doing something different.
It's getting more popular, you know? Yeah. Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. But he had another song that was huge. Midnight in Montgomery. It's from the same album, which is the story of a late night visit to Hank Williams Sr.'s grave. I need to, for everybody here, I need to say, not only is Hank Jr. not dead, I know we mentioned him earlier, but he and his father are very different musicians.
That's true.
And this song is about visiting his grave and being haunted by Hank's friendly ghost. And it was a hit, which I love. I think that's so funny.
The CMA video of the year according to this video.
Yeah. Alan Jackson was kind of a pioneer when it came to music videos in country. Sure,
apparently.
It's like a ballad. The video's kind of spooky. And you can even see that, like, there's a silhouette that looks like Hank Williams Sr. like talking to him. It's got those, like, square shoulders. I just love that he had country hits with these songs. I
dig this one. There's a band at one of the lovely honky-tonks from Broadway that would cover this one every once in a while.
Oh, that's a good one to cover.
Because you can definitely rock it up, you know?
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah.
That's great.
Well, those songs are good. I would not say they are the songs most synonymous with Alan Jackson to the general public.
That's true.
I think it's safe to say that much of the pop music-leaning public does not know these songs, or couldn't tell you who sings them. You know what song they do know, and they know who sings it? Chattahoochee by Alan Jackson.
That they do. Even I did. Fuck.
In 1992, after the success of his first two albums with Arista, Alan was getting to work on his next record. Pressure was high for more hits to further launch him into household name superstar status. Again, working with his pal, Keith Stegall, Alan sat down with songwriter Jim McBride to get some ideas going. Clearly, Alan knew what he was doing when it came to writing a song, but it's Nashville tradition to call some buddies and collaborate, even if an artist is a top-tier songwriter. Jim McBride is from Huntsville, Alabama, where he grew up listening to the Grand Ole Opry with his family, later also idolizing Hank Williams Sr. and Don Gibson. He started writing songs as a teenager in the 60s and met fellow Alabama songwriter Curly Putman, who had moved to Nashville and found success, and subsequently started a publishing company.
I love Southern people with weird-ass names.
Like Curly Putman?
Nobody bats an eye at that. Up north, you'd be like, the fuck? But down there, like, yeah,
I don't
cool.
even play. That's Curly.
Yeah.
Curly mentored Jim and helped him get some of his songs on the hit country music primetime comedy show Hee Haw.
Hee Haw.
However, Jim didn't see any money from the songs and kept trying to make a living for several years until he quit songwriting and left Nashville. Jim was a postal worker in Alabama for the next 14 years.
Wow.
In 1980, he started writing again, and he co-wrote a song called A Bridge That Just Won't Burn with another writer named Roger Mira. They were excited about the song, and McBride said if the song was recorded as a single, he'd quit the post office and come back to Nashville. One night, Roger called Jim and said, I guess you need to pack your bags. We've got Conway Twitty's next single.
Oh, shit.
Jim quit the post office the day after Christmas 1980 and moved back to Music City.
Damn.
A Bridge That Just Won't Burn by Conway Twitty was on the Billboard Hot Country Songs chart for 17 consecutive weeks, peaking at number 3. It won the BMI Country Award in 1981.
I don't know if I know this song.
There's that Conway hair.
Oh, yeah.
This is definitely in his, like, saccharine ballad period.
This feels like a very, like, old school song.
Yeah, definitely does.
Almost like gospel-ish.
Yeah, a little bit. So that happened. And then Jim had his first number one the following year, which kicked off a string of successful songs recorded by Waylon Jennings, Alabama, and Diamond Rio.
He's, all these folks at the end of their careers, he's really right in the hits.
Yeah. I feel like Diamond Rio was all the way up, but yeah. And then in 1987, Jim co-wrote a song called I'm a Survivor with none other than Keith Stegall, and it was recorded by George Jones.
Hmm.
And that's how those guys met. And then cosmically, Jim met Alan Jackson separately in 1988, and they wrote a song or two together for Alan's first two albums. And that's what brought the two of them together in Tallahassee, Florida in 1992, when Jim came up with the first lines of Chattahoochee.
Oh, here we go.
These days, Alan was on the road so much that he did a lot of his writing on the bus. So Jim joined him on tour so that they could write songs on the bus.
Love it.
In the liner notes of the 1993 album, produced by Keith Stegall, of course, that would eventually feature the song, Alan wrote, Jim McBride and I were trying to write an up-tempo song, and Jim came in with a line, way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, and it kind of went from there.
Iconic.
So this made me think, that is random as hell to just come up with that. Like, why would he name check the Chattahoochee River just out of nowhere? I'm pretty sure that I only know that river from the song.
Yeah.
So I need to know more. An interview with The Boot in 2015, Jim said he had just read a book.
I don't want to breathe over this. The Boot was the AOL's country blog of sorts.
It's still around.
Is it really?
I think it's independent now. I don't know if it's owned by AOL or bought by somebody else. But yeah.
I just feel like we have to memorialize for the fans.
That was AOL's country music site.
Yeah.
Jim did an interview with The Boot in 2015, and he said he had just read a book about the Chattahoochee. And he didn't say which book, so I did a little digging to see if any books about the river were released around that time, and I found two.
Oh.
One is Perilous Journeys, A History of Steamboating on the Chattahoochee, Apalachicola, and Flint Rivers by Edward A. Mueller.
Okay.
The other, which was published even closer to the time of songwriting, was The Old Beloved Path, Daily Life Among the Indians of the Chattahoochee River Valley by William W. Wynn. Could have been either of those, I was thinking. And then I found a piece in Atlanta Magazine that was looking back on the song for its 30th anniversary last year. And Jim said he got the idea from Sidney Lanier's 1800s poem, Song of the Chattahoochee, which he saw referenced in a magazine in his office. So I'm like, dude, which one is it?
Yeah. Well,
8 years ago, you said that you just read a whole book about the Chattahoochee River. And now you say that it was from this poem that apparently a lot of kids read in school.
Could have been from both. Maybe he was inspired to read a book after reading the poem.
Maybe.
And then the poem, obviously, is called Song. So like maybe he was like, oh, I should write a song about this book I just read.
Maybe. I don't know.
I'm going to go with he probably read the Steamboat one. because he's like a postal worker.
Yeah.
So he likes delivering stuff.
Oh, okay, I like
boats
it.
Boats carry things.
Perfect, perfect.
Like mail.
Well, the Chattahoochee River, for those unaware, forms the southern half of the Alabama and Georgia borders and a small part of the Georgia and Florida border. It's a tributary of the Apalachicola River, which I just mentioned. It connects to the Gulf of Mexico through Florida. The Appalachian Trail crosses the Chattahoochee's uppermost portion in Georgia, and its source starts in the Blue Ridge Mountains. It flows by Atlanta and Columbus, Georgia, on its way south. And as you could imagine, it's a popular destination for water sports such as tubing, kayaking, and whitewater rafting. We interrupt this discussion of a weird pop song to tell you about our friends at Dark Matter Coffee in Chicago, Illinois. Dark Matter adheres to a philosophy where quality coffees are sourced based on traceability, innovation, and social responsibility. They've created direct partnerships with farmers that allows them to directly source their beans from the plant to the cup. And we'd like you to try the coffee on us. So head to darkmattercoffee.com, fill up your cart, and enter code WantedToHitCast. That's all one word, WantedToHitCast, for free shipping on coffee beans from Dark Matter Coffee. Get freshly roasted. Are you familiar with the term redneck Riviera?
Oh, yeah.
Do you know? So you know what a redneck Riviera is?
Well, isn't that where you just link together a bunch of pontoon boats and party all day?
Yeah, pretty much. It's some body of water.
That's fucking great. Has my name written all over it.
Chattahoochee is often referred to as Redneck Riviera in a lot of places. There's like also some lakes and quarries that are connected to it.
Sounds lovely.
Yeah, sounds fun.
I don't think I've ever been.
In a 2022 Wide Open Country article by Addie Moore about the song, she says, "It's there that guys like Jackson fish for crappie, take their pickup trucks off-road, and gossip about their partners or crushes."
It's so wholesome. Love it.
And Chattahoochee State Park is, after all, in Alan's hometown of Noonan, Georgia.
Ah.
Yeah. Jim actually consulted an atlas that showed that the Chattahoochee bordered both of their home states. And he said, "Alan's hometown of Noonan is relatively close to Chattahoochee River, so I knew he'd be familiar with it. So I started just fooling with the guitar, and I got those first two lines out in a little melody.
The rest is history."
Kind of circling back to the books that Jim may have been reading, the Chattahoochee River vicinity was inhabited by indigenous people starting around 1000 BC. And there's a mound complex that was built by Native Americans between 350 AD and 650 AD, which is now a Georgia Historical Park protected land.
Hmm.
The river was a dividing line between the Muscogee and Cherokee territories. Chattahoochee is actually a Muscogee word that means painted rock.
Hmm.
The river was named for the colorful stones in its waters.
Very cool.
Yeah. Many of these native people were removed in the 1800s through treaties, land lotteries, and forced removals by the U.S. government to make room for European-American settlement. However, many indigenous people still live in the region, and there are tribes residing in the Chattahoochee River vicinity.
Hmm.
One more quick thing about the history. It was a very important strategic geological feature during the Civil War, utilized by the Union Army during the Atlanta campaign. And two of the last battles of the war took place at crossings of the Chattahoochee River.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of history here, not just country music.
Yeah.
Jim says he knew about the river since he was raised in Alabama. I can't figure out where exactly he got the idea. But he said he just started playing the melody, and he added those first two lines, and the lines are, "Well, way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, it gets hotter than a hoochie coochie." And I'm just imagining him playing this in a tour bus to Alan Jackson, and Alan's like, "Yep, it's done. Let's do it."
Hell yeah. I mean, it's a good line.
But what's great is that they know like where they started the song and where they finished it, and they start it in Tallahassee. And then they finish it the next day in Thibodaux, Louisiana.
All right.
So it's crossed some territory. And the song was already in such good shape that Alan taught it to the band at soundcheck, and they debuted it that night, a couple hours after it was completed.
Oh, wow.
I mean, this dude's a pro.
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that old Al was convinced it would resonate with people. His daughter, Maddie, has a podcast in which she interviews authors and musicians. And of course, her dad's been on the show. And they're talking about this song. And he said, when we cut that, it was such a fun up-tempo thing about coming of age. I thought, well, yeah, it's a fun song and I like it. And people in Georgia are going to like it. Nobody in the rest of the country or the rest of the world will know what that is or care about it.
That's untrue, Mr. Jackson.
Clearly, he was wrong. He further explained on the podcast. He said, I learned right quick that everybody has a Chattahoochee.
Right.
He said, it might be called something else or might not even be a river at all, but the story has something everyone could relate to in their life, no matter where they're from. So you just never know.
I was kind of thinking that. It does resonate. You kind of know what it's about, what's happening, without really even having to have context.
Right. Yeah.
Which I appreciate that. That's good songwriting right there.
It's very good songwriting, yeah. It was not the first single from the album. The album had actually already gone to 2 on the country album charts when it came out. And when Chattahoochee came out, it had dropped to number 15. And it sold 500,000 copies. That's doing okay.
Yeah, yeah.
But then the single comes out, sells 500,000 copies, and he sells 6 million more albums.
Wow.
Straight to number 1.
Damn.
But if it were up to Aris in Nashville, we may never have heard Chattahoochee at all.
Dun, dun, dun.
There's a documentary about Allen called Small Town Southern Man. And in the documentary, former BMG executive Gary Overton says, nobody wanted to put out that song but Allen. The song was so off-brand for a mysterious country crooner, and the music video treatment was kind of crazy, which we'll get to in a minute.
I mean, they're not wrong.
No, they're not wrong.
I know Gary. He's a legend in Nashville.
Oh, I didn't know the name.
Yeah, he was, ran labels for forever.
Mm.
Yeah, it is a big departure from what all the stuff we just heard.
Yeah, absolutely. Musically. Yeah. But in my opinion, this song is strange, mostly because of the lyrics. And also, it is unlikely, because clearly his label didn't want to release it, and then he didn't even think that people were going to relate to it. And then it was such a massive crossover song as well. Just a funny song to have made impact, you know,
yeah,
across genres and different types of people. And I know that especially in the time since this song came out, and especially these days, there are a lot of silly and stupid. I'm not calling this song stupid. A lot of stupid country songs that get popular on country radio. But this is a different time. Like, country music was still like pretty serious a lot of the time. We know from our Achy Breaky Heart episode, people were pissed off about that song. And that was only 2 years before this.
That's true.
If you'll remember, the Oak Ridge Boys refused to record it because breaky is not a word. I mean, that song was a total anomaly at the time. Probably wouldn't be now, though. I mean, I don't think either of these songs would be. And both were phenomenons. In fact, I saw someone in a Chattahoochee t-shirt at a show last summer where I was seeing the band Watch House, who is like, you know, they're like contemplative, like gothic folk music.
But hey, yeah, man.
Right?
Everyone's got a little Chattahoochee. Yeah.
So that all said, the strangest thing about the song is the lyrics. So I want to unpack these a little bit.
Oh, please do.
The first is the obvious. I'm going to take a sip of beer before this. It's the second line of the song.
The hoochie coochie part?
It's hotter than a hoochie coochie. Yeah. Yes, it's the hoochie coochie part.
Mm.
I'm sure we all have our theories. I'm pretty sure they just wanted something that rhymed with Chattahoochee. What I was thinking, and I didn't find many other people discussing this, but I figured that they knew the word hoochie coochie from Hoochie Coochie Man by Muddy Waters, which was written by Willie Dixon, because that was a huge song.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm the hoochie coochie man. Everybody knows I'm here.
I did find a lot about how much Alan Jackson is a blues fan. And he's.
Well, what is Muddy Waters referencing as the hoochie coochie man?
Well, I can tell you.
Okay, please.
Hoochie coochie, at its root, is used to describe several provocative belly dances dating back to London in 1851, and then making their way to America. And it was a precursor of the striptease, is how I read it. And I actually think it originated in the Middle East, from what I could find. It was a popular attraction at the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago.
Sure.
And then I also read, you know, hoochie coochie can refer to just an attractive person. It can refer to a lot of, sexual innuendo. And this all makes sense because in terms of that song, the Muddy Waters song, which was written by Willie Dixon, they reference gypsies and voodoo and sex in the song. So like all of it checks out. In fact, yeah. In his autobiography, I Am the Blues, Willie Dixon said of the song, "This guy is a hoodoo man. The lady is a witch. The other guy's a hoochie-coochie man. She's some kind of voodoo person." So it's all like kind of around this sort of like, you know, kind of nefarious nightlife kind of thing. And I do know that hoochie-coochie was also used often during Prohibition. People were going out to juke joints and carrying on at speakeasies, etc.
Well, that's what I was thinking, yeah, because hooch obviously is moonshine.
Right. So. And yeah, I didn't see anything. There's nothing about Jim or Alan addressing the phrase like when the song was popular. Like, there are no interviews about them talking about it. There's nothing there. My guess is that they couldn't find anything else to put in that part that rhymed with Chattahoochee. And I would imagine it gave the record label a little bit of pause. Like, all right, I mean, people might make some assumptions about what this means. Either because it was silly, but also because, you know, these radio DJs, you know how they are. They're squares.
Sexual. Yeah.
I can't be sure that they're referencing it, but I did, as I mentioned, read that Alan is a huge blues fan. He's covered multiple blues classics. He has songs about the blues, like paying tribute to the blues heroes. And I'm like, dude, he definitely knows this song. 100%.
Yeah.
He definitely knows Muddy Waters and knows the song. And it's just a super famous song. So I'm making the connection. I didn't find any real evidence, but I'm doing my own journalism here.
I mean, people might write articles after this podcast comes out.
In the podcast, you wanted a hit.
Popular podcast host.
But then I did read in that Atlanta Magazine article, they asked Jim last year about the lyric. He said that Alan got tired of answering phone calls about it. And he started saying, call Jim and ask him. So he started getting phone calls from all over the country asking him what a hoochie-coochie is. And his answer was, a country fair strip show.
Hmm. Okay, but we're not far off from the original meaning.
Not far off. I'm also like, some of Jim's recall.
Right.
A little suspect. And I'm like, I don't know.
But I wonder,
like,
if like a county fair.
Were they really calling it that?
Well, yeah. Right. And county fairs, were they calling it like the Hoochie Coochie Show or something? Maybe.
Maybe. So I'm not making any assumptions, but I think it's perhaps possible they borrowed it from Muddy Waters.
Yeah, I'm going to believe that.
I'm probably not the first person to say this, but.
Well, clearly you weren't the first person interested in the answer.
Right.
Everyone's calling up Alan
Jackson. All kinds of speculation.
You don't have Alan Jackson's phone number?
I don't.
He would tell you to call Jim anyway. So.
Hey, Alan Jackson, blues fan, hoochie coochie. I mean, it's not really that far-fetched.
It adds up.
Yeah. Some more lyrics I want to talk about.
Please.
Are, so I settled for a burger and a grape snow cone.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the second most famous, third most famous next to Little About Living, Little About Love.
What did he settle for? Like, what was the other option?
Well, the lyric is,
we fogged up the windows in my old Chevy. I was willing, but she wasn't ready. So I settled for a burger and a grape snow cone. I dropped her off early, but I didn't go home. Down by the river.
That's like that's wholesome, if you ask me.
That's what I think, too. First of all, I think it's hilarious for a pretty serious songwriter to sing about grape snow cones at 35 years old.
100%.
I think that's great. And I was like, it's summer. He's at the cookout by the river, cruising around town. Mm-hmm. It's a great day. Mm-hmm. He gets hungry. A burger and a grape snow cone. Love it. Like, we're on vacation every day. Amazing. Yeah. But then there was a TikTok trend in the last couple years where people would post a video of the lyrics and then have some realization. You know, it's like one of those videos where they're like, oh, that moment when you realize. And they were saying that they were realizing that that lyric was sexual innuendo for a number of activities, depends on what video you watch, because they're saying that because he says, I was willing, but she wasn't ready. They're like, oh, well, she wasn't willing to do the deed with Al. So he settled for something else that he called a burger and a grape snow cone.
Okay. No, that's not what I got.
I'm not sure I buy that.
I'm sure that there is a sexual thing called a snow cone. I have no doubt about that. I don't know what it is. I can imagine, though, and I'm not going to. And Alan Jackson is not into that, whatever it might be. I guarantee that.
Also, like, I can't imagine them writing this song and being like, oh, yeah. You know, sometimes people call that burger in a grape snow cone. Put that in there. I don't buy it.
I mean, they're drinking on the tour bus on the way to Louisiana. I actually don't know. Now I'm second guessing myself.
I found a couple of things on the internet, like written things that I don't think are substantiated, that we're trying to support this. None of them have alluded to this. I think it's
the line is a good wholesome song.
Yeah, you know,
like he was ready, she wasn't,
right?
And so they went and got burgers.
I kind of love that Alan and Jim have just kept it cool and quiet, like laughed all the way to the bank. It's almost just like an inside joke.
And maybe it is.
Yeah. But I did find a blog post that I found was so interesting, titled "Why Alan Jackson's Chattahoochee is the Feminist Anthem We Need."
Okay.
And I couldn't find the name of the writer on the blog. I don't know why their name wasn't on there, but they say that this song serves as a shining example for consented flirtatious behavior and the respect of sexual limits.
Hmm.
Yeah. The blog's called The Happening. You can check out the article. It's very amusing, and I think she makes some great points.
I mean, yeah.
And it's mostly about this lyric, and she says, Jackson's carefully worded line suggests that ongoing positive verbal consent is a hallmark of this sexual encounter. And then she says, does the young man stay and try to persuade her mind? Does he do the unthinkable and ignore her wishes? Does he pout that he doesn't get his way? No, no, no. He drops her off safely at home. Instead of brooding that he didn't get to go all the way, he settles for a burger and a grape snow cone. Then he drives to the river, presumably with male friends, and enjoys a pyramid of cans in the pale moonlight. There's no spitefulness extended to the young woman by the young man. Jackson creates the character as a party-loving good old boy, but it's far from the country songs of today that suggest cheap liquor-soaked young men lusting over women in tight jeans.
Yeah. Damn. I love that.
I think it's great.
That's amazing.
I love it, too.
Alan Jackson, feminist hero.
Let's watch the music video for Chattahoochee.
I'm excited for this.
You remember this video?
No.
Really? Dude, it's iconic.
Maybe I might see it. I mean, it's iconic for you because you had TNN. And you were watching this.
Oh, dude.
I already love it.
Before the song even comes in,
I mean, Alan Jackson,
he's on water skis,
in ripped jeans,
in jeans and a hat.
Is that a pay water ski? What do you call it when it's one ski? Yeah,
is it just one? Oh, it's like a wakeboard.
I love. Oh wow, I got a truck in the water. I love his life jacket.
His life jacket looks like a Nerf commercial. I also think it's interesting he's wearing a Dallas Cowboys jersey because he's an Atlanta guy.
Yeah, don't love that. Cowboys are America's team.
But they definitely were at that time.
Well, we fogged up the windows in my old Chevy.
There's the burger and the grape snow cone.
I just heard that line, and I paused to figure out. Oh, you're right.
There's also these shots of him, like, just in the boat with his hands in the air, like, being glamorous. Yeah. Man, those are really good lyrics. Like, never knew how much that muddy water meant to me, but I learned how to swim, and I learned who I was.
I know. This is some great lines.
A lot about living, a little about love. Like, man.
It reminds me of Red Dirt Road.
Yeah.
Or Brooks and Dunn. Very, like, coming of age, the roads, the connecting feature. I like these red and white boots he's got here.
Oh, the red and white boots that he's riding the wakeboard with?
Yeah.
Also, I love in the video, too, so wholesome, that these people almost run over a turtle, and then they get out of the car to check on the turtle. It's amazing. I mean, this guy is a wildlife activist, feminist, yeah. Like
feminist.
An all big party at the end with some fireworks.
It's a great video.
That's right.
Yeah, it is great. It's classic. It was directed by Martin Kahn, who directed a bunch of country videos. And Alan came up with this idea. And one of the reasons he was a pioneer in country music videos is because he came up with every video concept himself.
Wow.
He was the one that came up with all those iconic videos, and a lot of country artists were just going through the motions like, I guess we got to make videos now. I'll do whatever you want. Yeah. And they're just like standing in a bar or whatever. And his were like high concept. We're going to be in a graveyard and there's going to be like a silhouette of Hank Williams coming up on me. And this one, literally, he said, because the label said he had a crazy idea for the video. He just said, I had a vision of myself water skiing in blue jeans and cowboy boots.
I kind of hate the label. They don't like the song. It's a great song. And then they're like pissy. They're like, you made the fucking video yourself. It's great. And then they probably made a fuck ton of money off of it.
I mean, they're rude. Music Row Squares. What do you expect? He came in fucking shit up. He's kind of an outlaw. Yeah. I like it.
I'm very into this.
The song was quite successful. It entered Billboard's Country Airplay chart and Billboard's Hot Country Songs chart at number 72 in 1993. And that was in May. And then it was number one on both charts by July.
Well, I mean, it is a summer jam.
Number one for four consecutive weeks. It won the Academy of Country Music Awards Single Record of the Year, the American Music Awards Favorite Country Single, ASCAP Country Awards Song of the Year, Country Music Association Awards Single of the Year, the CMA Song of the Year, and the TNN Music City News Country Awards Single of the Year.
Sweat.
And it was on the album titled A Lot About Living and A Little About Love.
Dude, great.
Yeah. Along with three other songs written by Jim and Alan.
Thank God Jim quit his postal career.
Yeah, right? He didn't write songs for 14 years.
He probably would have had a great pension at the end of all that, but yeah. I think he won out.
Yeah, I think he did. And the album was on the top of the top country albums chart for 159 consecutive weeks.
Holy crazy. Shit.
As it reached number one. This song also peaked where on the Billboard Hot 100?
Big song.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely a bit of a crossover.
Mm-hmm.
Not number one.
Mm-mm.
But I'm going to go number four.
This is going to blow your mind. 46.
What?
Yeah.
Give me the other 45. How?
The other 45. Well, it's funny because I decided this time, because it was a little lower on the Hot 100, which we've had a few of those for sure. Still big cultural impact, but just didn't hit the right formula to get there. Not enough pop stations wanted to play country at this time for sure.
True.
You know, I don't know about single sales. There's all kinds of questions that I have. But I thought we should go through the 10 that was around it. The 41 to 50.
Okay.
What do you think?
I don't know, because are those songs that came and went? Do they become...
Not all of them. Some of them are huge songs.
All right, let's do it.
Okay. Number 50 is Don't Walk Away by Jade. I don't know if I know that song.
Hmm.
But number 49 is Two Princes, Spin Doctors.
Oh, I just heard that the other day, and I was thinking this song we got to do at some point.
Yeah.
It's a great song.
48, Tupac, I Get Around, huge song.
Big song.
47, Very Special, Big Daddy Kane. I love Big Daddy Kane. I'm sure he had a bunch of songs that were hovering around this area on the Hot 100. 46 was Chattahoochee. 45 was When I Fall in Love by Celine Dion, the main song from Sleepless in Seattle.
Yeah. That's probably in the come down.
It's on its way up.
Okay.
44, Your Boys, Radiohead, Creep.
Hate that song.
You can't hate that song.
I hate that song.
Oh, God. 43.
Love that band. Hate that song.
Yeah. 43, DJ Jazzy Jeff and the Fresh Prince, Boom Shake the Room.
Wow. What a time.
I know. This chart's great. Like, all these songs are great.
You're right. This is such a diverse mix of what's happening in the world.
Yeah. I don't know if I know number 42, More and More by Captain Hollywood Project.
No, I want to hear that, though. That's, yeah. I'm looking
at it. Cue it up.
Captain Hollywood Project?
Mm-hmm.
Not the first song that pops up when you type them in, by the way.
Oh. Maybe they have some other hits we know. it's on its way down. It looks like it peaked at 36. Oh, wait, I know this song.
Type in Captain Hollywood.
Oh, I definitely know this song.
Yeah? It feels familiar, but I wonder if it's familiar with what it feels like.
I mean, it's one of those typical, like, house songs from the 90s with the deep voice talk singing rapping in it, and then female vocal in the chorus. Yeah, this is very, like, Technotronic, CNC Music Factory.
Yeah.
Pretty sure I know this song from A Night at the Roxbury. And then number 41... a Tears for Fears song, Break It Down Again, which,
oh hell yeah,
I mean, great band. As far as covers, it's been covered a million times by country artists, mostly live. There's nothing notable. It's all sure. Just like them kind of doing karaoke, you know. Probably gets played every night on Broadway in Nashville.
Oh yeah.
As far as the Where Are They Now section, there's not a whole lot to share here. Jackson went on to make country hit after country hit through the 90s, into the 2000s. He's still married to Denise.
Oh.
They have a few kids who are grown now, some of which we know are podcasters. Others are musicians and writers. I mean, Alan's always kind of been a little quiet about his personal life, doesn't do a ton of interviews, just kind of hangs out, it seems, makes music and does things he enjoys. One of the reasons he's not on TV much anymore, like people like speculate, why isn't he at award shows? One reason is that he says he wants to make room for other people to be on TV, which I think is cool.
It's cool.
But he also has a hereditary motor and sensory disorder, which makes it hard for him to stand up at a microphone. So he, in 2022, did his farewell tour. He did make an album in 2021. I feel like he might make some more. And again, he doesn't do a lot of interviews. So when the song's 30th anniversary came around, there wasn't much from him. He didn't have any like great wisdom about it or like tell us what it all means. He just kind of let it float. Songs for the people.
Appreciate that.
Notably, George Jones has been such a theme here. Alan Jackson, remember he sang He Stopped Loving Her Today on the contest show on TNN. He sang He Stopped Loving Her Today at George Jones's funeral, 2013.
Damn, that's cool.
That comes full circle.
Yeah.
He's a huge fan, writing songs about him. Like, wow. That's pretty incredible.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Were they friends? Are they?
Yeah, I think they
must have, right?
They seem friendly. I saw a couple things about like them, you know, meeting and whatnot.
That's cool.
I don't know how close, but I don't know how much of friends you can be with George Jones.
Yeah, fair.
Very like erratic character and hard to get along with. So, but Alan's just like a super cool as a cucumber guy. So I don't know. Maybe that's the perfect
country boy.
Yeah, maybe that's the perfect match for a friend for George Jones.
Yeah,
Jim and Alan have some thoughts on the song. Jim said a lot more for sure. Jim said, the truth is, if Alan's had a bigger impact single than Chattahoochee, I wish someone would tell me what it is. And that's to my point. Like, Alan Jackson is just synonymous with this song, even though he had other huge hits and had more after this. In the liner notes of this album, I read something earlier that Alan Jackson wrote. He also wrote, it's a song about having fun, growing up, coming of age in a small town, which really applies to anyone across the country, not just by the Chattahoochee. We never thought it would be as big as it's become. And then McBride said, I'd never experienced anything like that before. It was amazing what happened. People just associate with that song. With most people, there's a river that they have memories about.
It's true.
In that Wide Open Country article that was written by Addie Moore, I like what she said about the song. She said, Alan Jackson is rightfully celebrated for honoring country's rich past, but one of his greatest hits pointed to the genre's fun in the sun future, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
She said the song shares themes with the more criticized works of someone like Kenny Chesney and others associated with hedonistic trips where their favorite river flows. Though old souls could argue that Jackson simply added some levity to traditionalism, dreaming up something that's no more silly than A Boy Named Sue. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there were people that were like, this song is stupid, similar to like, as we said, Achy Breaky Heart, though this is a much better song.
Well, I think like I said earlier, I feel like as a young kid growing up in the Northeast, yeah, you hear the song and you're like, it just sounds dumb when you're young. You don't really can't place it. It just sounds like, you know, country being country. But
yep.
Listening to it now and listening to it as someone who's a fan of country and is more connected with the Southern culture, it's like, yeah, it's such a jam. And it's like, I didn't really think about it being such a wholesome song as well, but it is. So it's been a fun ride. And I think you're right. Like in that quote, kind of referencing, like, was it that much of a departure from what he was doing? Maybe it wasn't.
Just writing what he knows and trying to relate to people.
And I have to imagine, like, being when you're a country artist is touring his second album, playing a lot of the songs that he was playing live. Like, I think as you play live more often, you kind of feel like you want to do more fun songs for the crowds, because some of the songs are a little sleepy, a little slower. Mm-hmm. And then you're playing the songs every night and you're like, fuck it. Like, I need something a little more upbeat. I need something a little more jammy. Like, I think it's natural as you get more into that space that you want to write more of these songs with levity to them.
Yeah. I mean, he was at the peak of his touring career at the time. So that definitely makes sense. And they're having, like you said, they're having fun in the bus, writing songs, probably having some drinks, you know,
cracking some natty,
driving from state to state. And both of them are like, holy shit, I can't believe we're here. Like, yeah, I can't believe this is where our road led, and all our hard work. But I was thinking about, like, kind of, you know, the things I don't like about modern country music. And I can see how this song, well, there's no way that this song alone caused that, but I could see how it did influence some of that coming from the 70s, 80s,
Sure.
Right? The early 90s, things were starting to change a lot.
But you have guys our age who we could blame for some of this more modern country who grew up with this song, but also grew up with the Garth Brooks of the world, the Kenny Chesney of the world.
But Garth Brooks was also writing songs about domestic violence. Like, these guys had a lot of depth.
Oh, sure.
Them.
But there was also levity to old country songs. It just sounded different. It was sonically different.
Yeah.
Always been.
Johnny Cash was writing about eating chicken and strawberry cake, like, you know, for a minute there. So, you know.
It's no different than hamburgers and snow cones.
Right? Yeah. That Atlanta Magazine article is actually really good, the one that Sarah Carter wrote last year. And I like how she sums it up. She says, it'd be hard to estimate the number of children in the South who read Sidney Lanier's The Song of the Chattahoochee in their junior high literature classes. But it's not hard to estimate how many people were so affected by the poem's melodious title that they grew up to write the song about the Chattahoochee River. Only one. And that's Jim.
Hell yeah.
And she goes on to say, even if you've never been to a county fair strip show, even if you can't swim, the song's appeal is undeniable.
I agree.
Jim says some interesting things too that I wanted to mention here. He said, I remember we were sitting at an award show. I think the year we got Song of the Year, I'm guessing at the CMAs. And he said, Alan Jackson turned to him and said, you know, they may still playing this song when we're 70 years old. And I said, well, they might. And he said, well, you'll be 70. I'll only be 60. Jim said, I'm now 75, and that song is like having a single every year.
Oh, I love it. Getting that mailbox money.
Yeah, right. And then one more quote. I know I've had a number here, but they're all good. Want to go back to that blog post about the song being a feminist anthem. It says, more and more modern country objectifies women. However, Jackson proves that a lighthearted song can be both catchy and respectful of women. Jackson is an award-winning lyricist. Many fun-loving songs fall to the cliche of easy rhymes and lackluster lyrics, but Jackson eschews these common pitfalls and crafts his masterpiece. This summer, I plan on cranking the volume to 11 and reveling in this feminist anthem projected by my cheap speakers.
Hell yeah. Us too, mystery writer. Us too. That was fun. Good episode.
Yeah, this song it really has endured. Like, I still hear it all the time, hear it at weddings. I went to a wedding in Nashville, my buddy Kurt, who I'm sure you've met, a few years ago. And he actually hired Zach Schmidt and the Santa's Ice Cold Pickers from Santa's Pub to play their wedding.
That's fun.
And they played all kinds of country hits. It was great.
Sure.
They played Chattahoochee And then everyone freaked out so much that they played it again. I mean, it was just...
I love it.
Yeah, it was great. And everyone was having such a great time. I feel like even some of my friends who aren't into country music or aren't into more poppy country music, however you want to say that, I feel like they even like this song. Like, it's just... It's really permeated, I feel like, yeah. And continues to.
I'm here for it. And I don't think I even appreciate it as much as I do after this episode, now that we've ran through it.
There are a lot of reasons it almost didn't happen. Like, just there, yeah. All the stories of the people involved, and then the record label didn't want to put it out. Alan didn't even think it was a hit. They could have changed the lyrics, like, just all kinds of things.
I'm surprised the label didn't like it.
Well...
I know, but it still feels like a hit. Like, you listen to the song, it's catchy as hell.
And again, it was what, 2 years after Achy Breaky Heart? Like, how much dumber can it get?
But maybe that was the hesitancy.
Well, they might also have not wanted Alan to fall into that trap after he'd already become, like, the kind of neo-traditionalist icon that he was.
Right.
Where he's playing by the jukebox, you know, and... singing about his heroes, George Jones. People are like, yeah, that's what I want to hear. I don't want to hear this.
I'm sure that was more of it than
Billy Ray Cyrus stuff. And he's like, yeah, but what about Hoochie Coochie and Grape Snow Cones?
That's a wrap on this episode of You Wanted a Hit. Thanks for listening. Good luck getting that song out of your head. If you enjoyed the show, please do all the things podcasts usually ask you to. They really help. Tell a friend about the show, subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts, write a review on your favorite podcast app, and visit our website, ywahpod.com. That's ywahpod.com for updates on new episodes and our merch store. We have t-shirts, sweatshirts, hats, coffee mugs, stickers, and more, and it all goes back into the podcast. We would love to hear what you thought of the episode, and we also want to hear if there's something that we missed. You can reach us on Instagram and Twitter at ywahpod. Or directly via email at ywahpod@gmail.com. This podcast was researched, produced, recorded, and edited by me and Theo Beidler. And our theme music is by Air Doctor. We'll see you next time.